The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a special post-budget edition of the New Statesman podcast. I'm joined by Anoush Shakalian and Stephen Bush, who both write for our online Staggers magazine. And I, excitingly enough, can reveal that I was in the chamber for the budget. So I've got lots of top quality anecdotes that I can share with you first. But first of all, Anoush, what was, for you, we always talk about in budget terms, we always talk about the rabbit. What was the rabbit this time?
Okay, well, the rabbit is the thing which hasn't been trailed to the press beforehand and is going to be the headline policy of the budget. And I think in this one, I'd say it was the announcement of a national living wage. Now, I'm putting that in quote marks for listeners who can't see me, because what George Osborne promised was to have a compulsory national living wage for everyone over 25.
The minimum wage, as we used to call
it. Yes, the minimum wage, as it's known in common parlance, by 2020, which is quite an impressive political move because it makes it very difficult for those campaigning for the living wage and the Labour Party, who also spoke a lot about the living wage before the election, to continue pushing for that because it looks like the Tories have stolen a march on that policy.
It's a kind of your living wage isn't really a living wage. So, Stephen, I just want to pick a little bit of the detail for this. As I understand it, it's going to go up to £9 an hour, essentially the minimum wage, by 2020, and it's going to be compulsory to pay that to over 25s. But it will only start at £7 per hour next year, so it's on a pretty steep escalator over the next couple of years, I guess. And the problem with it for me is that the London living wage is already £9.15, I think. It was £8.85 last year. And there's been some research that's shown that if you take away tax credits, as they're doing, then obviously that has a huge effect on the people who are on minimum wage. I mean, they might be taking out income tax, yes, but these things are a really complex interaction. And actually, I'm not sure whether or not people really will be that much better off. How, as Labour, do you make that case without everyone going, snooze?
To be honest, I don't think that they do. I think one of the things Labour got wrong over the last 5 years is they didn't want to outsource any of their opposition. This is actually one of those things where, interestingly, people don't want to hear what the trade unions think about Palestine when you poll people, but they kind of trust trade union leaders on wages or on Sunday trading hours. They trust academics on wages, and ultimately they can feel things in their own pay packet. I actually think it's one of those things where Labour is probably best off going, I'm glad we all agree on a living wage now, let's talk about how to do it. Then, because at the moment we're just going, well, that's actually a living wage for Wales in 2012. It's not a real living wage now. That's quite a complex and arid argument to have. I think Labour doesn't need to get stuck in having a sniping commentary on everything they do.
My feeling was immediately that the better response was to do, it's really great that the Conservatives have come round to the idea of a minimum wage. We remember when the Labour government brought this in and you guys said this was going to totally tank business. So, ha ha, turns out joke's on you. And actually, yeah, like you say, let's kind of see how that's being implemented. It was quite smart, I thought, for Osborne to mention the Resolution Foundation. So that's you know, an independent think tank, but Gavin Kelly, who's written for us and was in Downing Street under Gordon Brown, has headed that up. So it was a bit of kind of political cross-dressing, really, as ever. And I also thought that, you know, linking together the defence budget and the foreign aid budget and saying that, you know, commitment to one means we've got to put our commitment to other was quite smart. And there were some other... Yeah, I think that the idea of it's interesting to talk about how you structure a budget speech to get people the kind of emotional narrative that you want, right? So this was very much the kind of final sunlit upland after quite a heavy passage about disability benefits, about housing benefits. So do you want to just run us through a couple of those, Stephen, of things that we know are going to happen to welfare?
So the Employment Support Allowance, which is effectively the rebranded Disability Living Allowance, will be reduced down to the level of Job Seekers Allowance. So that is a £30 cut. Of course, most people who are on some form of ESA are either working or have been declared unfit to work. So it is either something you use, say, if you need to get more taxis because you get tired, or to maintain your wheelchair, or, you know, any additional costs your disability may incur, or it is something which... as one of our contributors, Rosie Fletcher, in an excellent blog, and if you haven't read yet, listeners, you know, find it, share it with all your friends. You know, says, you know, she says, I use it to keep myself in tea bags, as it were. So, you know, that's a particularly vicious move.
There was a very odd line, which I can imagine is superficially very appealing, which is the best route out of poverty is work. And the problem with that is, as I see it, that depending on what definition you use, a huge number of households who are in work are still in poverty.
Yeah.
And it's quite an ironic thing for the Chancellor to say, having sort of done a raid on tax credits as well, because obviously those are people who are working.
The other one that I think is kind of one that I would like to see more come out in the wash is the idea that 18 to 21 year olds, haha, turns out young people that not bothering to vote, joke's on you, because now what's going to happen is there's this youth obligation idea, which is you have to earn or learn. There's no automatic entitlement to housing benefit. And the Osborne's argument for that is that, you know, lots of other people who aren't on benefits don't get to move out of home until they're 21, so why should people kind of go straight from school to benefits? He says there'll be exemptions for the vulnerable. I think I'm really interested to see what those actually are, because I think one of the problems are that it does that does reflect a particularly kind of middle class experience of having as soon as someone's moved out of, you know, home, then you're getting the bedroom tax levied on them if you're in a council house anyway, you know. I worry that that's going to mean that some people whose families have broken down, or, you know, they need to live independently, won't be able to move out of home. And that's not a comparable situation to the fact that, you know, you're at university and you come home in the holidays and your parents have left you the, you know, your childhood bedroom exactly as it was.
And I do think, in a way, these kind of measures are quite un-Tory, because you're basically going into somebody's house and dictating how they live and when they should move out and when they shouldn't move out and who they should live with. And it's a similar thing with George Osborne's policy announced today about how you are only allowed to have the tax relief that you have if you have children on two children. So it's almost like he's dictating how many children you're allowed to have if you're claiming benefits. So I think that's weirdly un-Tory, if you think about it.
It comes back to the big problem with the modern Conservative Party, which is they have a lot of people who are well-meaning but don't really grasp what a lot of people's lives are. I remember having a conversation with a Conservative researcher about payday loan companies when I was just like, well, you know, what if your fridge breaks down? And they said, oh, well, you know, someone would lend me money. I was like, yes, but people who turn to pay loans live in an entirely usurious universe. There is no one they know who can lend them money for a new fridge. And I think people, if you leave home at 18, you have a good reason to leave home. You know, no one is sitting there. Like,
I'd love to pay, you know, 600 quid a month for a tiny crap flat somewhere, just because then, you know...
You can only claim for a single room. So if you're getting housing benefit aged 18, you are living in, you know, a mostly, you know, silverfish ridden... Not even, most landlords won't accept people who are on housing benefit. Yeah, so a mostly silverfish ridden room on your onesies with some people you don't know. Yeah, that is not a choice people make because, you know, it's the life of Riley.
I think that's yeah, I felt that very much about the same thing about being chucked out. Was that feeling that, you know, what would happen if you can't find anywhere to live? And it was kind of, well, couldn't you bunk up with someone else? Actually, not everybody lives in a universe where they have lots of friends who've all got a spare bedroom. It's not like that. The other thing I thought hasn't received a huge amount of play so far is the idea that working age benefits have been frozen for 4 years. I mean, that, I just, I don't know. I mean, there, I guess we're in a state where the left spent a lot of the last parliament saying, you know, austerity is terrible, everyone's going to be out on the streets, there's going to be insurrection, it's going to be like the poll tax riots, and that never really materialised. And so there is a kind of gun shyness about criticising something like that, just in case people don't feel that. But surely they will. You got your head in your hands, Stephen. It's all been too much for you.
The thing is so my instinct is that we are sort of bumping up against the limits of what you can, how you can balance the book solely with frontline cuts. You know, cutting tax credits is the point where if you run a small business, you're noting that people are arriving late or leaving or they're commuting in from much further. It does start to have these kind of widely felt echoes. I mean, this may just be a straw I'm clutching at. The interesting thing is there were a lot of caveats. So, for example, the 18-year-old thing. You know, you can get so many exemptions. You go, oh, those savings didn't materialise. You can, if you make the fairly heroic assumptions about wage growth and some of those tax credit figures are based on, you can sort of keep some of them. I do think the problem is 50% of me feels that these possibly are cuts that are too great to get political permission to continue on. But my innate pessimism is that the left doesn't win by default. And my fear, actually, with the awfulness of this budget is it will encourage that kind of one more heave. It's really awful. We'll just point
people
out
just
it's
need
really
to see
awful.
How awful it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, and then we'll be back in 2020 attitude.
The thing that was from the perspective of being in the chamber that most struck me is how confident Osborne is now. He is big dog. Like, there was a moment when, towards the end, when he was talking about the living wage, when Labour MPs really started screaming, and he had to sit down, and the Deputy Speaker sort of popped up. And then he kind of popped back up again. He was like, well, I'll say it again, because apparently some of the opposition didn't hear me. And it was a real kind of, there was a real bravado to it. And there was also bravado when he talked about doing a memorial to something like Bomber Command. I'll have to look up the details. But it was basically an Uxbridge. And he said, you know, which would be particularly interesting to the member for Uxbridge, i.e. Boris Johnson, because it will commemorate a time when planes flew freely over the skies of West London. And then, you know, Boris Johnson had to sort of kind of sit there and go, and sort of wave his order paper a bit. But it was an obvious kind of taunt to, you know, to somebody who's going to find themselves in a very difficult position over the Heathrow expansion. I probably shouldn't say this, I'll probably get letters, but he did look caked in makeup, which I'm not necessarily sure is a great look for him, but he did look incredibly authoritative.
Yeah, I think, I know that we don't always trust the bookies, but I think he went up as the most likely person to succeed David Cameron the moment he sat down after doing his budget speech. So there could be an element, I think Harriet Harman mentioned that in her response, there could be an element of him looking towards next door, you know, in this budget.
Well, I think that's what Labour would absolutely... Yeah. I mean, Labour, you know, yeah, I think they can probably remember what it's like when you have an ambitious Chancellor who spends the whole of a term plotting to oust the Prime Minister. That is not an unfamiliar experience to them. I mean, you know, credit to Cameron and Osborne so far, they have always been an incredibly tight unit, and particularly astonishing to see that when they were part of the Quad with the Lib Dems as well. I mean, it had its troubles, but it lasted the whole way through that Parliament. Mm. But surely George Osborne's leadership ambitions rest entirely on whether or not people feel richer in 2020 than they do now. And to finish, Stephen, I mean, do you think this is a budget that suggests that they will?
No, I think it will have adverse effects on demand. I think I am a zealot for tuition fee models because there are a way to raise taxes on the middle class. But we're getting to the point where it's effectively a 3p increase in the basic rate for
Explain
people.
Explain that.
So basically, you pay your tuition fees directly along with your PAYE, so it's along with your tax. So it's basically just an additional...
This is your repayments.
A hike on your income tax. But obviously, at some point, you'd go, well, you can't raise income tax anymore. You're asking a bit too much of people. If you're raising it with inflation, that does get to the point where you're basically adding adding quite a lot onto basic rate and to the 40p rate for people who've come through the tuition fee model. People are going to start noticing that. I think the tax credits are pushing up against people's resilience. I also think it's probably too early to be the favourite. People get bored. Yeah, I think, you know, people got bored of David Davis in 2005. We've actually already seen within the Labour leadership, people kind of got bored of Andy Burnham. They were interested in Liz Kendall, and now they're kind of going, oh, maybe it's Yvette Cooper. Mm. And my gut instinct is it will probably be Yvette Cooper, but my gut is often wrong. And I think it's probably too early for George Osborne to be the favourite.
Well, We'll pick that up, no doubt, in a future podcast. But for now, I'll say thank you very much to Stephen and Anoush. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.